Hello and welcome to The World This Week with me, Gavin Lee. We're live here in Paris in a week that's seen Congolese rebels seize Goma, the largest city in the mineral-rich east of the DRC. Heavy artillery fire, explosions heard in the city as thousands fled. The UN says fighting broke out in every quarter, every neighbourhood. Rwanda blamed for backing the group known as M23, though the country's president denies it's a colonial enterprise. We're going to look at the key factors in the long, simmering conflict and where it's heading.
Countless lives have been lost. Enough is enough. Rwanda cannot be allowed to continue to act with impunity.
The week where hundreds of thousands in Gaza were finally allowed to return to the north and what remains of their homes. Israeli military opened the Netzarim corridor as part of the ongoing ceasefire for the first time since the start of the conflict. But the terms of the truce are being tested by the optics war. Hamas choosing a symbolic site to transfer captives. The ruins of the building where its leader Yahya Sinwar was killed. Israel was outraged.
During the release of our hostages today, we witnessed shocking scenes. Anyone who dares to harm our hostages will pay the price.
And it's a week that's seen the first major commercial air crash in the US in 16 years. An American Airlines jet colliding with a military Black Hawk helicopter in Washington, D.C. No survivors. Reports in the US suggesting air traffic control towers understaffed. President Trump, without providing evidence, blamed the crash on the Biden administration and diversity rules.
The FAA's diversity push includes focus on hiring people with severe intellectual and psychiatric disabilities. That is amazing.
Well, alongside me on the panel this week in London, the journalist Michaela Wrong, author of Rwanda, Assassins Sans Frontières, and previously awarded the James Cameron Prize for Journalism for, quote, a combined moral vision and professional integrity. Michaela, fantastic to have you with us this week. Let's also go to...
Thanks. Good to be here.
And to have you here too, Michaela. Let's go to Nairobi. Eric Randolph, the AFP Deputy Bureau Chief for East Africa, formerly based here with us in Paris, friend of the programme, also in Tehran previously. Eric, great to see you again. Thank you also for joining us.
Yeah, lovely to be with you again. Nice to see you.
And let's also introduce a guest in the studio, Victor Mallet, Senior Editor at the Financial Times, also author of The River of Life, River of Death, The Ganges and India's Future. Victor, great to have you with us on the programme, looking at big events that you are very familiar with. And also journalist and professor of journalism at the prestigious Sciences Po University here in Paris, Aishagul Sirt. Good evening.
Good evening.
To you, Aishagul, as well. Thank you so much for being with us. A lot to discuss, and let's jump straight in. We start in Goma, the largest city in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, the capital of mineral-rich province of North Kivu. It was there Monday that news came through of gunfire and explosions inside the city. A Congolese rebel group backed by Rwanda, known as March the 23rd or M23, who had been edging ever closer, was in the process of capturing it. Electricity, running water cut off, the airport closed. Those fleeing the city describing bodies left lying in the streets. And a mass jailbreak too, thousands of prisoners escaping. The UN envoy saying active zones of combat had spread to all quarters of the city, to every neighbourhood. And on Monday evening, I spoke to Martin Gordon, the Anglican Bishop of Goma, one of the hundreds of thousands of people who fled the city since the advance intensified back in January. He left this weekend with his family.
So yesterday, Sunday, was the day that the Rwandan army crossed over into Goma over the eastern border with many of the M23 rebels as well. And that's when they tried to take the airport. And then gradually yesterday afternoon, evening, and then into the early hours of this morning was when they took control of many parts of the city. And that's really when panic started to set in. People not knowing what was going on, who had control of which parts of the city. I think the wisdom up until that point had been if the M23 did again take control of the city.
Well, by Monday night, the UN Security Council had held an emergency summit, Western leaders calling on Rwanda to withdraw. UN intelligence analysts saying there is no question Rwanda is in control of M23 operations. And then a case of deja vu was back in 2012. The group briefly took Goma, but after US and European leaders threatened to withdraw aid money to Rwanda, The rebellion ended after 9 days. This time, the condemnation equally loud, but the threat to withdraw aid more muted. We'll look at why in just a moment. But on the ground right now, perhaps parroting a playbook we've seen of rebels establishing de facto rule, a press conference held on Thursday by the group known as the Congo River Alliance, principal member and leader of M23, Corne Nanga, previously the head of the country's National Election Commission, claiming that electricity, schools and normality was going to be restored, warning the militants were marching towards Kinshasa. Meanwhile, the man accused of financing and being in de facto control was Rwandan President Paul Kagame.
M23 are not Rwandans, please. These are Congolese, and one time he accepts it, then another time he says, no, part of it is yes, and then the other part is from Rwanda, and these are the.
Michaela, let's start with the immediacy of the situation. We just heard from Paul Kagame once again reiterating, in his view, his line that M23 is a different group to his, nothing to do with each other. What's your assessment of the situation? It seems fast-moving on the ground right now.
Yeah, there hasn't been that much news today of what's happening on the military front. But I know that yesterday what everyone was seeing and talking about was the fact that the M23, having effectively seized control of Goma, a bunch of mercenaries who were white mercenaries who were working for the Tshisekedi, Felix Tshisekedi's government in Congo, they had gone into Rwanda and surrendered there and been disarmed. So had a group of Congolese fighters. And that the M23, therefore, was heading south along Lake Kivu, this very long, beautiful lake, heading towards Bukavu, which is the capital of southern Kivu. And that there were also reports of Rwandan troops massing in Changugu, which is on the Rwandan side of the bottom of the lake, opposite Bukavu. I spent quite a lot of time in all of these places in the past. And that there would then be a pincer-like movement, an attack on Bukavu. And that's certainly what the population in Bukavu are expecting. It's also what the Burundian army, which is in a peacekeeping capacity, is expecting. And there are reports that it has been massing around Kavumu Airport, which is not far from Bukavu, presumably to protect it. So this is a situation that's extremely fast-moving and escalating, because we could be seeing the zone of conflict just moving down to Bukavu next.
When you hear, Michaela, that there's a march intended for Kinshasa, and your previous year's vast experience there, pure propaganda, or is there method to the message?
Well, there's a real Groundhog Day feeling for people like me, because I was working in in the area back when Laurent Kabila, who was the head of something called the AFDL, which was another rebel group that was basically created, funded and armed by Rwanda. And at the beginning, he was supposedly be the spokesman. And everyone saw that this group was sort of seizing tracts of land in the Kivus. And they also used to talk about marching on Kinshasa. And everybody laughed uproariously, because it was ridiculous. If you look at the distances, you know, Kinshasa's on the other side of the African continent almost. I mean, it's a vast, vast country. But they got there. And they toppled President Mobutu, Mobutu Sese Seko. That was the end of his regime, because nobody came to his support at the end. And then, you know, Laurent Kabila went from being a spokesman to being the next president of and renaming Zaire Congo. So I think you know, all bets are off, because we know that the government in Kinshasa is not exactly strongly supported by its own armed forces.
Eric, very interesting listening to Michaela. Ghosts of the past that if you don't heed the warning could come back to haunt. Eric, Kenya previously trying to broker a peace deal. I think President William Ruto appealing to leaders of both DRC and Rwanda to go to an emergency meeting early this week. Felix Tshisekedi of the DRC wasn't involving himself in that. What's your take on the Kenyan influence here?
Well, we're seeing a bit of a divide between the East African community and the Southern African development community. Ruto has tried to play peacemaker here. He's always very busy on the international front. But unfortunately, I think the divide is so stark between Paul Kagame in Rwanda and Felix Tshisekedi in the Congo that trying to bring them together at this point is looking increasingly difficult. They already had peace talks several occasions during the last couple of years that basically fell apart in December. And what we're seeing now is the aftermath of the failure of those talks. They looked close to coming together on some sort of deal in December. Those talks failed, and Kagame looks to be acting to show his strength and to embarrass Felix Tshisekedi by seizing this regional capital, showing his strength and also showing the weakness of the Congolese army, which have really been routed. We were expecting, you know, we've had teams in Goma all week. We were worried about huge firefights in Goma and large numbers of refugees being forced across the border. We have seen violence and we have seen some refugees, but it hasn't been on the scale that we feared. And actually, the M23 seemed to take control of Goma relatively easily. So at this point, trying to bring these two leaders who really do seem to detest each other on a very personal level together seems very difficult.
Very difficult indeed. Victor, your view here on what is there, the mineral-rich East. Rwanda suddenly has, I think it's a gold exporter now, never having been a notable player before. Does that speak of the links of East Congolese mines and territory recently picked up?
Yes, I mean, everybody says that what Rwanda wants is the mineral wealth of Kivu in eastern DRC. That's what seems to be going on. It's a lot of rare metals like tantalum that are used for smartphones and that kind of thing, as well as gold. So you've got a whole bunch of minerals that are being exported discreetly via Rwanda, it seems. But what I take from this is a much more sort of, in a way, it's a sign of the whole breakdown of the international order. I mean, we've already had large powers like Russia, you know, invading Ukraine, China throwing its weight around in the South China Sea, and now we've got Trump's America talking about taking Canada, Greenland, and Panama. And now you have smaller states like Rwanda, you know, relatively strong armies compared to their neighbours, and they are starting to feel that they have a green light because there's no one in charge, there's no one telling them they can't do it. Israel is camped out in Syria and Lebanon and says it has no plans to leave, as well as what it's done in Gaza. So you have a kind of situation where it's a free-for-all. It's a dog-eat-dog world, as Trump would say, and we're in a very unstable situation, I think, when there is literally a breakdown of that post-World War order in the way things are run. So, you know, we now all expect maybe the UN Security Council to do something about Rwanda, but will they agree? Will they actually threaten Rwanda with withdrawal of aid? I mean, we don't know where it's going to go, but the omens are not good if you have the major world powers and the permanent members of the UN Security Council themselves ignoring international law, which they've all been doing.
And while we're on air, Victor mentions the international reaction, this new world order. Aishigal, France proposing a draft resolution to the UN Security Council saying it's, quote, trying to increase pressure on Rwanda. We're not seeing exactly what's in sanctions, withdrawal of aid at this stage. What's your sense of European efforts here to resolve the crisis?
It's very slow. It's very slow, and the question I have, maybe it's to Michaela, because she was talking about having a feeling of déjà vu because she was on sur le terrain on site. But what is the difference between 2012, when Rwanda again had tried to basically do what it's doing now, and was the response, the international response, was so strong, so immediate that they had to retrieve? What is the difference 10 years later, or like 12 years later, that makes that the sanctions are coming at a very slow pace, the international response is coming to a very slow pace? In a way, one of the reasons probably is what Victor mentioned, the world of 2012 and the world of 2025 is unfortunately different. International law seems to be on the back burner or what we are going towards. But it's also interesting. I mean, I think Paul Kagame has not arrived today in just you know, in just a day. It's been 10 years of building Rwanda in his image on the international as kind of like the beacon of life, the beacon of hope, and the beacon of Africa to follow in order to maybe that's why the international response is taking so slow, because in a way, what we are seeing today going on in Goma is a failure also of us seeing what has been going on for 10 years.
Michaela, it's a very good point, isn't it, from Aishikul, the difference between 2012 and now. And it's probably, if you can, just talk us through some of those geopolitical complexities, France and its sensitivities of upsetting Rwanda, Britain and Rwanda and the US too.
Yes, it is very, very different. And but I would take issue with Kagame having spent 10 years building his brand. He has spent 30 years building his brand because although he wasn't nominally president after the genocide, you know, he was always running the country and everybody always knew that. He only became officially president in 2000. So he's had, you know, he's been doing this for 30 years and he's really good at it. And he spends a lot of money, using PR companies and taking their advice and putting it to very good use. I think the difference is one of self-interest. The scene, the international scene, is fractured by self-interest in that the Americans have long looked at Kagame as a sort of bulwark against Islamic jihadism. He's got this fantastically efficient army, which we are seeing going into going into action in Congo, making a laughing stock of the peacekeeping forces there, but also the Congolese army. No big surprise. This wonderful, efficient, you know, well-equipped, superbly trained army. So the Americans count on Paul Kagame to be the policeman against Islamic jihadism. The French, as I'm sure you know, they are counting on Kagame for the same reason. They announced this wonderful aid package with Rwanda a year and a half ago because the Rwandan soldiers are protecting the Total installation in Mozambique. And the Brits, you know, here in the UK, last year, up until the elections last year, where the Conservatives lost to Labour, they were absolutely bent on sending asylum seekers to Rwanda. And Rwanda was one of the few African countries that accepted that deal. It's an incredibly densely populated country. It was the most inappropriate place in Africa to send unwanted migrants. But Rwanda was up for it. And it was a clever calculation. It ended up getting four asylum seekers in the end. The deal collapsed. It was cancelled by the Labour government. They got a whole load of aid money as a result. And for all the years that project was being debated, challenged in the courts here, no one in the British system would utter a word of criticism about what they could see Rwanda was doing in Congo and the support it was giving the M23. So I think Kagame has been incredibly clever, playing off you know, these various interests, offering the West, various Western countries, exactly what they want. And you know, the EU has certainly been co-opted as part of that, I think partly because of the French role in the EU. So at the end, this what used to be a united front in 2012 and stopped Kagame in the M23 in its tracks, that aid suspension just hasn't been there this time.
If we look, Michaela, at a word on the abilities or relative strength or relative weakness of the Congolese government right now and what it can do, what's your assessment?
Well, I gather that there are a lot of Congolese soldiers who were routed, who ran to Bukavu. I think, to be honest, there was a reason why the Congolese army was relying on Romanian mercenaries to fight for it. There was a reason why there was a SADC, a southern peacekeeping force. You know, because it has never had, Congo has never, since the days of Mobutu, had an army on which the government could count. And there's a good historical explanation for that. Mobutu used to make sure that his army was divided, faction-ridden, underfunded, that he used to set all his generals one against the other because he was terrified of a military coup. And Tshisekedi is not in a stronger position than Mobutu Sese Seko. So I think there's always been this gaping hole where the security services in Congo was, and they've had to rely on outsiders, you know, for decades and decades, they relied on foreign governments sending troops to do their fighting, and they've had to do that recently. So I don't think they're in a very strong position. I do think that it's really vital that the West and the international community steps in with real sanctions, real trade embargoes, putting high-profile people on travel, you know, travel ban lists. I mean, that is a message that Kagame will listen to and that will have some impact.
And Michaela, as you say, we're still in the eye of the storm here as this is playing out. Leaving Africa's second largest country, heading 2,000 kilometres north of Goma to the third largest country in Africa, Sudan, where on Sunday, army chiefs held a press conference telling reporters after almost 2 years of civil war, they'd broken the siege of the capital, Khartoum, claiming it was finally a major turning point in their favour. And in a conflict we discussed several times on this programme, one that's led to the worst displacement crisis in the world, 12 million people forced to flee, and a huge death toll, an estimated 150,000 dead. The two figures that instigated this conflict, two generals, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the head of the Sudanese Armed Forces, and Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, the leader of the Rapid Support Force, former allies who carried out a coup together but who've torn the country apart on their fight for supremacy. Well, a turning point this week, we're told, on a week that the prosecutor of the ICC announced he will be seeking arrest warrants for those accused of atrocities in Sudan's West Darfur region, which has seen reported ethnic cleansing by Rapid Support Force. Also allegations from both sides committing war crimes. Eric, let's start with you and your reading of the celebratory announcements of the Sudanese army this week that the war is at a turning point.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a danger when we see any kind of breakthrough in this stalemate that's lasted for so long and has been so devastating, to feel that perhaps there's something positive to be seen in this, and that perhaps this will mean that we're getting closer to some sort of resolution. Unfortunately, I think although the Sudanese army has been having more successes on the battlefield of late, we're still a very long way from any kind of end game in this conflict. We still have many outside countries, particularly the UAE, that have been a big funder of the Rapid Support Forces on the other side, who I'm sure are not going to want to give up on the vast investment that they've put into this horrific war, and as well as seeing no doubt many a long continuing battle in the months to come. We also have the reports of ethnic cleansing by the Sudanese army and all sorts of attacks on civilian infrastructure. I think the UN this week was reporting attacks on water infrastructure, on dams, on bombings of civilian marketplaces, reports of continued sexual violence against civilians. Unfortunately, a lot of that is going to continue, and I don't think we're very close to any kind of positive resolution.
Victor, we're not close to any positive resolution anytime soon, says Eric. I don't know if that's your view as well, but let me also widen this out. I asked you a short while ago about the DRC, the minerals. I think gold is a big factor here, and you've got geopolitical support, different players like Egypt backing the RSF, the UAE, Chad, Central African Republic, backing the Sudanese armed forces, the UAE, Chad, Central African Republic backing the RSF. Talk to us through the neighbouring countries and what's in it?
The weird thing about Sudan is that it is this massive tragedy, a famine, atrocities on an unimaginable scale, and really the world hasn't talked about it very much because the great powers and because Israel, you know, America, Russia are not directly involved in a way that they can be seen in any case. So the world has really not paid attention to a lot of Sudanese with Gulf support killing each other and committing these terrible war crimes. And that, I think, it's sad that we can all sit back and not pay any attention when we should be paying attention. But yes, it's a classic sort of civil war, I suppose, that, and because it doesn't actually involve, strategically essential supplies of critical minerals or anything else, then the world isn't actually that interested in it. Of course, there's oil, of course, there's gold and there's minerals, but, you know, these are not on a on a scale of say Kuwait or anything like that. So the world is just not paying attention, and a bunch of sort of lesser powers, if you like the UAE and like the Saudis, are involved, and they are contributing to the problem. And again, we have the sort of logjam where the international community, the United Nations Security Council, is not able to get its act together and do something about it. It is a bit harder in this case to sort of to do something about it, because it is a civil war in which, the two parties were both, part of a Sudanese government in the past. And really, they both need to be excluded from power in any future government of the Sudan. And that, of course, is going to be difficult, especially if one side now says it's finally winning, which is very much open to doubt. I mean, we had a contributor from the Biden administration in the FT, the Financial Times, the other day, who basically said, Sudan is Gaza on the Nile, because it's this kind of awful tragedy that is quite impossible to solve or very difficult to solve.
Gaza on the Nile. Aishugal, Jan Egeland, who's the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, just a few weeks ago said this, quote, the world has failed Sudan completely by not doing enough. And he said of Europe, so much more needs to be invested financially and engaged to avoid, quote, a future refugee crisis. What's your assessment?
Sudan is kind of, if there's a worst case scenario of what can happen in a war, Sudan is that place. It's first of all, because there are all these superpowers. There's also Turkey on the side of Russia that has been playing as well on the field. But there's also the fact that there's ethnic cleansing that Eric was detailing. But we should also not forget that there are also chemical weapons that are being used. I mean, the New York Times this week came out with a lot of reporting of how finally the U.S. was going to use sanctions against the use of chemical weapons somewhere in the world happening. There's also the fact that which the U.S. has not done, let's remember, in Syria or in 1988 in Halabja in Iraq, when the Kurds were chlorine, where basically chemical weapons were used. So finally, the U.S. is doing something. But on the other hand, Sudan is the place also where the U.S. is maybe not going to do much because of, we'll talk about what Mr. Trump has been, the foreign aid that he has been freezing, that he decided this week. This is, Sudan is going to be one of those countries and is already one of those nations that where people are at the brink of famine, where there's such a need for healthcare. And here you're an American president who says, we will do sanctions because we're against the use of chemical weapons. But at the same time, we are cutting off the aid that we are giving them in order to have one meal a day.
Michaela, just listening to Aishugal and the difficulty on the humanitarian situation, she also mentioned the US. The US recently sanctioned the RSF on account of purported genocide in Sudan. We spoke a moment ago, didn't we, about the ghosts of the DRC, well, the ghosts of Darfur past are there too, aren't there? The genocide committed 2 decades ago with the previous incarnation of the RSF, the Janjaweed.
Yes, and by the way, just in passing, Rwanda's peacekeeping forces were successfully deployed in Sudan, which shows that they can play a positive light when they're used in the right way. But yes, I mean, this is a long, suppurating sore that has been going, this has been going on and on and on. And I think what from my perspective here, I've been talking to people in the Labour government and talking about, Labour's foreign policy. And one of them was saying to me the real area in which Labour has failed in terms of foreign policy. This gaping hole is really that it hasn't taken a leading role on Sudan. This is used to be a British colony. This is a country where, many of my grandparents' generation worked in Sudan. There's an incredible strong links between Sudan and Britain. They go back, hundreds of years. And Britain, should have been showing that it was willing, that it took on that responsibility of getting people to engage with this conflict. And it really hasn't. I think it's a sign of how small the British vision, post-Brexit, that we are becoming ever more inward-looking. And that's as true of Labour as it is of the Conservative Party.
Well, that might explain then why David Lammy recently took a trip as well to show renewed interest in trying to do something about it. It's a very good point, Michaela. Now, from the situation we were looking at...
Yes, he did, but it was quite late in the day.
Yes, in 21 months in. Well, from the situation in Sudan, incredible scenes in Gaza on Monday. Aid agencies describing a, quote, river of humanity on the move as many return to where they once lived to see if anything remains. First time since the initial week of the Israel-Hamas conflict, they were able to return north of the Strip as part of the ceasefire deal. Hundreds of thousands returning and will need all the help and humanitarian support they can get, given a reported 75% of all buildings destroyed. But there's an issue of what happens next to the group bringing the majority of aid into the territory. The UN relief agency UNRWA banned from operating by Israel on Thursday, who alleged that some of its employees were involved in the October the 7th attacks. Well, its workers also support Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. On Thursday, the official spokesman for Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, gave this update.
We've seen the letter addressed to the President of the General Assembly. I mean, our position is unchanged, right? For the Secretary General, he continues to believe that the work of UNRWA is performing the occupied Palestinian territory is essential and that there is no alternative to UNRWA as we see it.
So the ceasefire deal is holding and heading towards a third week, but it's tested every day. Thursday this week, in a latest choreographed Hamas release, strange scenes in Jabalia in the north. An Israeli hostage, Agen Berger, captive for 15 months, here she is, led by masked gunmen to a platform, handed a certificate from her captors before being handed to the Red Cross team. Then hours later, chaotic release amongst jostling crowds as two more Israelis and five Thai hostages released in the ruins of the former home of Yahya Sinwar, where the Hamas leader met his drone-captured end. Here are those scenes. Now, because of that, Israel briefly delayed its part of the bargain to release Palestinian prisoners until it received assurances from Hamas those scenes wouldn't be repeated in future swaps. Aishagul, let's start with the scenes we've witnessed this week and how it's resonated with you.
Before the scenes, there's something I'd like to share. A couple days ago, I was with a former, having a conversation with a former ambassador of the US, and he said something that really I think is right. He says that whoever speaks with whomever he speaks last is that decision that he's going to take. So I wonder if at some point, in terms of the truce, not only in terms of Gaza but also in terms of Lebanon, whether Mr. Netanyahu is going the last man to whisper to Donald Trump's ear, because that's going to kind of decide what happens in the first phase, for instance, of the truce. The second thing is also to come back with the images. It's I could not believe that, you know, Donald Trump has not been a president for 2 weeks yet. But God, it's been a long 11 days, and I can't imagine how long the 4 years is going to feel like. He used this week a wording that really, while I was looking at the images that you showed of the Palestinians coming back to their home, which is 75% rubble and nothing left, is he was talking about the need to clean out Gaza. As if, and I wondered where the human part was in that man when he said that. It was for me really a real estate agent almost talking of looking at that space that could be turned into something new. That also I think shows signals to a couple days and weeks that are not going to be even if it looks very fruitful, it's very fragile. Mm-hmm. What we are seeing. Then there's also the fact that I must say, for once, I was very surprised to hear the leaders of Egypt and Jordan. That said, to another craziness that Donald Trump came up with when he said that, you know, the Palestinians, if there's nowhere they can go, they can always go to Jordan and Egypt, where they're already Palestinian refugees. And the two countries, which, let's not forget, Israel and Egypt are the two countries that the U.S. helps a lot in terms of ammunition, in terms of, you know, arms, but also in terms of money. So the fact that Egypt was to say, look, Palestinians will go where Palestinians are supposed to be, which is their homeland, was something, I think, for once that showed me that the Arab countries maybe finally, after all these decades, are able to be united on the side of the Palestinians.
Eric, just listening to Aishagul on the situation, those extraordinary scenes this week, it's also worth saying every possible moment is being used in the optics war, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, perhaps it's overly cynical, but I don't see this as a ceasefire so much as just another element of the ongoing war that I don't think has any chance of ending either. Perhaps this is just recapping what I just said about Sudan, which is depressing, but there seems very little likelihood to me that this will present any kind of opening for a wider peace process. You look at the pressures that are on Netanyahu to protect himself from the corruption cases that he's facing, from the extreme right members of his cabinet who would just like to see all Palestinians eradicated. You see the support that he's very likely to get from Trump. The fact that he's already given Trump a free win immediately after he took office by allowing Trump to claim credit for this ceasefire deal. I see very little likelihood that Netanyahu is going to see this as the start of any kind of major negotiations on any of the root issues, as if there are any solutions to those root issues. And I think the scenes that we saw from the Hamas release, the hostage releases this week, will only provide further justification, as if he needed them, to violate the ceasefire at some point sooner or later, just as he has the ceasefire that was agreed with Lebanon towards the end of last year.
And yet, Michaela, just listening to Eric on the very common view, let's face it, of how long this truce may last, we are going to see a big moment this weekend, significant because the Rafah crossing is about to open, to which we'll see EU observers back in place, those needing desperate treatment able to get out of Gaza, more trucks going in. Do you see the fact that the cogs are still in place on this deal as a positive?
I don't know. I tend to agree with Eric's view that this is just a temporary situation. And this is an incredibly fragile ceasefire. I suppose some cogs will start working again. But presumably there comes a point where Hamas isn't going to want to release any more hostages, because once it's released all the hostages, there's absolutely no reason to talk to it at all. So I would have thought it's very unlikely that all the hostages will ever be released, and that, you know, the further this process goes along, the harder it will be to envisage that the last remaining hostages will ever be released. So it seems to me it's already nearly collapsed so many times, you know, so soon after being announced, that I do wonder how much how many attempts will be made to rebuild or get life going again, because, you know, it is so obviously fragile.
To what extent, Victor, do you see Aishagul saying that, you know, it could be the last person he speaks to and be influenced by would be Benjamin Netanyahu, but to what extent do you believe that Donald Trump could bring about change in terms of a deal, a permanent deal? There is talk, those supplicants for him saying that, you know, he really wants to see the Nobel Peace Prize. What's your view on that?
Can you get the Nobel Peace Prize if you've just called for ethnic cleansing of an entire population, as he did in Gaza? I mean, let's not forget, the US president has called for ethnic cleansing of Gaza. This is an extraordinary moment. And the idea that we should all be worried about a little bit of publicity by Hamas, yes, it was shameful, but it's incredibly minor when you compare it to the war crimes committed by both sides in this appalling war. You know, the idea that they wouldn't do it, of course they're going to do it. I mean, I think, you know, in a way, what we take out of this is what I've said before, is that Trump's professed desire for peace, you know, not wanting to get involved in wars, and his very open desire to support Netanyahu are two incompatible aims, I think. I just don't think those two things can be reconciled, because, you know, Netanyahu is not a peacemonger, he's a warmonger, and that is the way that he sees himself and the way he presents himself, and that is the method by which he is, I think, as you just said, you know, staying in power. So yeah, we're in a very fragile situation. And I think one of the things that we have to look at is to say, has Israel's war strategy in Gaza worked? And I think the answer is no. I mean, Hamas is now incredibly popular in the West Bank as a result of what it did in Gaza. It's not so popular in Gaza, of course, because the Gazans have been completely slaughtered in tens of thousands by the Israelis. But in the West Bank, on the other hand, because of the release of Palestinian prisoners and because there is finally somebody who is standing up for the Palestinian cause in the views of those people in the West Bank, you know, they've got a lot of credit, and that is going to, and we're already seeing tensions and fighting in the West Bank as a result of this. So I'm afraid I have to echo your other correspondents, including my former colleague Michaela Rogge, that you know, it doesn't look good, and it's hard to be optimistic at the moment.
No, on the face of things, that's the position we're in right now. And as you mentioned a moment ago, it's hard to avoid the headlines made by Trump and co. this week, 11 days into office. A week of, did he just say that? He said there was a freezing fund across all federal agencies, the civil service in the US, in order to stop billions of dollars being wasted. This is how it unfolded. On Tuesday, almost all federal employees got an email offering them the option to resign and receive pay for the next 8 months. Donald Trump's new press secretary, the youngest ever at 27, made the point on who would be affected.
It means no more funding for illegal DEI programs. It means no more funding for the Green New scam that has cost American taxpayers tens of billions of dollars. It means no more funding for transgenderism and wokeness across our federal bureaucracy and agencies.
It was unclear which programs were to be frozen. Federal funding goes from everything: food stamps, Medicare, Medicaid insurance, education programs, farm subsidies, foreign aid, pensions, student loans, etc. Within 24 hours, the freeze was temporarily blocked by a Washington, D.C. judge. Then the White House said it had temporarily rescinded the order. And then we saw confirmation hearings get underway from Wednesday, arguably the three most controversial choices for U.S. government positions. They are this man, Kash Patel, head of FBI. He's a former Trump aide, previously called for the FBI headquarters to be closed, accused dozens of staff of being members of the deep state. And there's Tulsi Gabbard, former veteran who served in Iraq, director of national intelligence. There are questions over her past proximity to President Assad, President Putin, and her support for Edward Snowden. Then RFK Jr., vaccine skeptic for Health Secretary. Ahead of his appearance, his cousin Caroline Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's daughter, former U.S. ambassador to Australia, had this word of warning about him. Whatever
he does, he lacks any relevant government, financial, management, or medical experience. His views on vaccines are dangerous and willfully misinformed. These facts alone should be disqualifying. I've known Bobby my whole life. We grew up together. It's no surprise that he keeps birds of prey as pets, because Bobby himself is a predator. I watch his younger brothers and cousins follow him down the path of drug addiction. His basement, his garage, his dorm room were always the center of the action, where drugs were available, and he enjoyed showing off how he put baby chickens and mice in a blender to feed to his hawks. It was often a perverse scene of despair and violence.
Okay, you have to take a moment to take that in. Michaela, what is your take? All picks for Donald Trump have so far gone through bar one. What's your sense of these three candidates and the jobs they're taking on?
Well, I think because of my perspective, I'm most concerned about the ones that involve the security, the FBI, and intelligence, because those are the ones that will have an impact on the rest of the world. And it's just hair-raising to think that that these kind of candidates are being put in place and really challenging. To imagine that they will be confirmed. It's been a very exciting couple of weeks since Trump was confirmed. I do think, though, I think it's almost impossible for us to do, especially since, we're journalists, that it's very hard, I think we're going to have to, as people who work in the media and analysis industry, we're going to have to find a way of dealing with the Trump administration. I don't think we really found a way of doing it last time. But in terms of not responding to every single outrage with outrage, you know, not responding to every sweeping announcement, every casual, you know, devastatingly ridiculous, cretinous statement, you know, those press briefings at the White House, for example, you know, where apparently they're now going to let all these YouTubers and, you know, I think we're going to have to learn to calibrate and not, because otherwise we're going to spend, you know, the next 4 years in a state of complete hysteria. And I think the danger is that people are going to all be distracted from what is actually happening as opposed to what is being said. So I think the media and the world of sort of think tankery and academia and it's going to have to find some kind of way of getting to grips with this disruptive technique that Trump uses.
Aishka, we have 30 seconds. I know you wanted a brief word on this.
I'll be very fast. Since Eric was a little on the negative side, I'll finish with a positive side since it's TGIF. But it's very interesting. I was in New York when a couple of years ago when basically Biden won and Trump lost, and I had an editor-in-chief who's been, you know, a senior editor-in-chief who looked very sad, and he's a longtime Democrat. And I said, what's going on? You know, it's kind of a good news that Biden is coming. He said, yes, but journalistically, we are going to be so bored because for the past 4 years on Trump won, we had so much going on. But the difference, we were talking about what's the difference in DRC and 12 years ago and now, for instance, is that the word, remember, Trump said drill, baby, drill a couple days ago. Now it's revenge, baby, revenge. And I think that's what we are going to see.
Aishkul, thank you. Not just us, but stenographers this week saying that they are having to call in more staff. There was more than 22,000 words that he spoke on Inauguration Day. They are struggling to keep up. Thank you for watching. Thank you for my guests as well, Aishkul Sirt, Victor Mallet, the FT. We also have Michaela Wrong, the journalist and author, Eric Randolph, AFP Deputy Bureau Chief for East Africa too. Stay with us. We'll be back in 7 days for The World next week.
In 2020, hundreds of thousands of Thai youths took to the streets. Their demands, reform of the monarchy and the end of the military regime.
I knew that protesting meant I could be arrested, falsely accused and prosecuted.
5 years later, the movement has fallen silent.
I'm here all the time. I have 14 cases against me. We waste our time and sacrifice our careers just to attend hearings and prove our innocence.
But the most determined refuse to give up. Thailand protests revisited on France 24 and France24.com.